And now, back to Brainstorming with Billy.
The Living Brain.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is potpourri. Each of my guests has an interesting subject to share with us, no two of which are alike. My next guest is a best-selling novelist. Typically, I don't interview novelists, but the premise of his latest book, Blood of the Reich, fascinated me. We'll discuss the secret and controversial Nazi mission to Tibet in 1938 and its impact on Hitler and the world. And as always, if you want to ask a question or join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Big shout out to a loyal listener, Robbie, down in Camarillo. Thank you for calling in. You were the winner of the sandwiches or salads from Urbane Cafe. And to all of those who didn't win, we'll have more giveaways next week as well. My next guest, William Dietrich, grew up in the Puget Sound in the shadow of Mount Rainier. William was born on September 1951 in Tacoma, and he graduated from Mount Tacoma High School during the culturally tumultuous 1969, and he attended Fairhaven College, which was an experimental liberal arts college division of Western Washington University. Interested in actually getting paid for his writing led him to a career in journalism at Western, and his first job was covering the agricultural Skagit County for the Bellingham Washington Herald. In 2006, he took a half-time position as an assistant professor teaching environmental journalism and writing at Western, advising a student magazine called Planet, for which he is extremely proud. William left the position in June of this year to focus more on his writing. William's latest book is Blood of the Reich. It's based on a 1938 Nazi expedition to Tibet. It ranges from Berlin to Central Asia to Washington State to Geneva, and it explores the mysterious ties between an imperiled young Seattle woman and a contemporary conspiracy. William is married to the wonderful woman that he met in college. They have two grown daughters, four grandchildren, and when William is not writing, he likes to read, hike, sail. He travels. He's been to more than 36 countries and waves around his Roman cavalry sword, which his wife got him when he was writing an earlier book. Welcome to the show, William. How are you doing?
Real good. Thank you.
Thank you. I have this picture now of you waving this Roman cavalry sword in my mind. Now, this was for a book that you had written earlier, and was your muse for that particular book?
Yeah, it's called Hadrian's Wall. It's a novel set in the late Roman Empire on the Roman frontier in Britain. And the Roman cavalry had a sword called a spatha. Looks something like the short infantry sword people are familiar with. But this one is longer because you're using it from horseback, and it was just a fun gift on the part of my wife to keep me going on the book.
Well, it paints a very vivid picture in my mind, so that's good. But let's focus on your latest book, because I love World War II. But truly, truly, William, I thought at this point there wasn't a subject about World War II that hadn't been written about, and you proved me wrong. You found a bit of history that's shrouded in both mystery and it's underreported. That was that 1938 Nazi exhibition to Tibet and the Nazis' belief in virile. So what piqued your interest about the 1938 Tibetan expedition?
Well, I was the same way. I was surprised to find out that the Nazis had gone to Tibet, which in those days was absolutely a forbidden kingdom. Nobody except the British had any relations with it. It was a theocracy, very mysterious, very religious. And Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS and the Gestapo, wanted people to go there for a couple reasons. For one thing, he thought the ancient Tibetans might be related to the ancient German Aryans. He was hoping to prove Nazi race theories. And the other thing was there was this oddball idea that had arisen that there might be a mysterious power source called Vril that it would have originated in Tibet, and that maybe this was a real thing and they could really find it. And so this is the kernel of truth the novel is based on. And then, of course, I take off from there and fictionalize things a little bit and tie it in with this contemporary Seattle woman who, much to her surprise, learns that she has connections to these events that have happened more than 70 years before.
It's a fascinating read. Now, William, it's interesting because you chose the 1930s and the 1940s as a backdrop for this, for your historical novel, and that was a very fruitful time for innovation. I mean, many of the things that we take for granted today were invented or perfected during this time. Jet planes, rockets, television, radar, sonar, nuclear weapons, and even quantum physics were all really either discovered or perfected during that time. So what is it about this period in history that made it so innovative?
Partly it was the war. I mean, in the military buildup on all sides, I think, accelerated technological innovation. And so some of these things, including nuclear energy, came out of that conflict. But I also think there have been some breakthroughs in basic science. Our whole understanding of physics had been revolutionized by people like Einstein. Our understanding of biology, what we were beginning to suspect, the genetic code and looking for that. And so these two things in combination led to this incredible period of innovation. And I think it was clear to the world's leaders that the winner of the war would be the winner of the technological race. And so both the Germans, the Americans, and the British, they were all in this sort of headlong rush to try to find something that would give them an edge.
And you leave the Russians and the Japanese out of that. Is there any particular reason why? Did you not feel that the Russians or the Japanese were interested in the scientific progression, or is there just an oversight?
Well, you know, apparently the Japanese also pursued the idea of atomic energy and did not get very far at all. I don't know about the Russians. I think Russia was still very much a developing country industrially. And, of course, you know, they were the ones who really defeated the German army, but they defeated it not with technology but with millions of people and just brute force.
Yeah, exactly. My guest is William Dietrich, author of the new novel, Blood of the Reich. We're talking about that particular book. So, William, you tackle a couple of big subjects in your book, but what is one of them is this whole idea of Nazism. What is our continuing fascination with the Nazis?
Well, for one thing, they're the ultimate evil. And so if you're a novelist, you know, you're glad, you'd try to invent them if they hadn't actually existed. And so that's why they turn up as a foil so many times. I was also fascinated by why Hitler was appealing to the Germans to begin with.
Yes.
He does not strike me as a terribly charismatic figure. Neither do people like Himmler or Goering or the other top Nazis. And so the theory, and I tried to develop this through the novel a little bit, is that what Hitler offered to a defeated Germany was the idea that not only were they the equal of the nations that had defeated them, but really they were the superior, that they were the master race. And I think this idea of telling people that they're special is a way to get them to follow you. And Hitler understood this. And so in my novel, people play with this idea as well. And so the title Blood of the Reich, it sort of has multiple meanings, but one of the meanings is this idea of ancestry, of race, of DNA, of superiority and inferiority, and all these things that really roiled the world back in the 1930s and 1940s, but really still trouble us today. I mean, I still think we have fundamentalist groups, extremist groups that are, tell their followers essentially that they are special and that therefore they have a license to prey on other people.
Even the neo-Nazis, and we have a strong neo-Nazi contingent in this area, so that's an interesting perspective. My guest is William Dietrich. William, it wasn't just the German people. I mean, I understand your explanation of the Hitler's fascination for the German people. They needed to be propped up after World War II. Feeling superior made them feel great. But even Hitler influenced people outside of Nazi Germany. In the United States, Charles Lindbergh, the great American hero who flew across the Atlantic, was influenced by that, and the Duke of Windsor, who abdicated his throne in Great Britain, was also influenced by that. What was the fascination, or what was it that spellbound those types of individuals as well?
Well, Hitler was a leader. I mean, he was an evil genius. He turned Germany around. He organized society in a way that had never been organized before, and I think people initially found that admirable, or at least intriguing. And, of course, the world was seemed very dysfunctional at the time. It was the Great Depression, you know, sort of like the period we're in right now where people are very frustrated with the recession and political gridlock. And along comes this guy who seems able to do anything and everything and sort of cut the knot of frustration and get things done. And so you're absolutely right that in the early 30s, Hitler had admirers on both sides of the Atlantic.
Yeah, without a doubt. Well, I'm going to ask you to fast forward to our current time, and you mentioned it in that last answer about the political, the economic environment right now is maybe ripe for some sort of rise of another strong-willed leader, if you will. And you see this in politics. In France, it's probably most obvious with Jean-Marie Le Pen and his daughter, who are xenophobic, almost fascist people, taking over large, large counties in France itself. Do you think that this environment would be rife for another charismatic, yet fanatical leader like Adolf Hitler to rise?
It's possible. I don't think you could ever duplicate Hitler because, you know, people know what a disaster that was. And so any politician could not go to those extremes. But certainly in Europe right now, you have Muslims who are sort of taking the place of Jews as being resented. You've got economic turmoil. You've got political frustration. I don't think we're nearly at that point again, but certainly in a number of European countries, we've seen a rise of the extreme right. And again, people simply looking for solutions, looking for strong leaders.
My guest is William Dietrich, author of the book Blood of the Reich. And one of the more subtle themes that you deal with in the book, William, is the connection between the ambitious materialism of the West and the serene, almost fatalistic approach of Tibetan Buddhism. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, there's a scene in the book, and it's taken from history, but here are these German Nazis. They've traveled 10,000 miles all the way to Tibet, climbing the Himalayas, getting up to the Tibetan plateau. They've brought along pith helmets with SS lightning bolts on them. They've got little pins with Nazi swastikas because they know the Tibetans regard the swastika as a good luck symbol. And they march up to the Potala Palace in Tibet's capital, this fabulous building, in their black SS uniforms and Death's Head insignia. And they say, "We want to be friends, you know, that we're like you." And so in the book, I've got this chapter where this meeting takes place, and they're talking about these differences. And the Tibetan regent says, here, and with Buddhism, we're trying to, you know, get away from ambition, that we're seeking serenity, and you guys are exactly the opposite. You know, you believe ambition is life's purpose. And so it's a sort of East-West clash that I found fascinating. In the novel, as in real life, though, there was sort of a temporary alliance of convenience because the Tibetans felt threatened by any number of nations, and so they were at least intrigued by the idea of possibly using Germany as sort of a big brother to protect them. But that in real history, that did not go very far, and in my novel, it turns out that both sides are trying to use the other.
All right, my guest is William Dietrich, author of the book Blood of the Reich. And William, you yourself personally have traveled to 36 different countries over your lifetime. How and where did you travel to do the research for Blood of the Reich?
So for this book, I went to Tibet, which was fascinating. It's now a province of China. China invaded the country in the 1950s and forced out the Dalai Lama in 1959. So the elderly gentleman, the people have heard of the Dalai Lama, he was 3 years old when my book begins. He had already been identified as the reincarnation of the previous Dalai Lama, but of course he was not yet ready to rule. So the Chinese chased him out and have replaced this bureaucracy with their own communist capitalist system. And so when you go to the capital city of Lhasa today, the majority of people are Chinese, not Tibetan. There's a lot of real go-go capitalism, and the country is being exploited for its natural resources. And Tibetans are really struggling with this. On the one hand, they're getting modern conveniences they never had before. But on the other hand, they've lost their freedom and independence, and by some estimates, something like 1 million Tibetans have lost their lives since the Chinese invasion and various resistance movements.
Wow.
And so they'd like independence, and yet it's almost a situation like American Indian tribes being overrun by the dominant white culture and then trying to go backward from there.
Amazing. My guest is William Dietrich. William, what do you want readers to take away from reading your new novel, Blood of the Reich?
Well, it's a historical thriller. It's a commercial entertainment, so that, most of all, I hope they have fun. But beyond that, I think they're going to learn a lot. They're going to learn something about Nazi Germany, learn about Tibet, the political situation there, learn something about Tibetan legends, the legend of the Shambhala Kingdom, and actually learned something a little bit about particle physics. You know, I had this problem in the novel how was I going to get this sort of 1938 quest and update it to the present day? And so that's why the book actually climaxes at the super collider outside Geneva, Switzerland, where physicists are looking for the secrets of the universe. And I realized that we are on a quest right now that isn't all that different from the quest the Germans were on back in 1938, still trying to figure out what the universe is made of, and still on the verge of possibly finding new powers and new properties that could really transform civilization and transform politics.
Amazing. William, what did you get out of writing this book? Because this is a departure for you. You've departed from your main character that you've had as a thread throughout your other novels. What did you get out of writing the book?
Yeah, I've got a series called Ethan Gage Adventures. It's an American alive during the Napoleonic period, and so he interacts with Napoleon. Kind of an irreverent guy and a lot of fun. And we're continuing that. There'll be another Ethan Gage book out at the end of May next year. But I wanted to take a break and do something a little bit more somber, serious, terrifying, if you will. And also, you know, just sort of indulge my fascination with the Nazi and the World War II era. And my fascination with whether all this stuff people were kicking around in those days, whether there was any real substance behind it. So I just had a great time doing this novel. As I said, I went to Tibet. That was fascinating. I talked with physicists at CERN, which is the super collider. You know, they gave me some ideas for the book.
We're going to have
to learn, and I hope readers learn as well.
And they will. It's a great book. We're going to have to leave it there. My guest has been William Dietrich, author of the book Blood of the Reich.